So before we jump into things today, this deep dive is actually brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got this this full Series 7 course, and it's got adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Yeah, that weighting is super important.
It really is. So you can check all that out at CertFuel.com. But let's dive into the actual topic today, because when you buy a stock, I think people forget that you are basically buying this highly abstract bundle of rights.
Right.
It's like a digital blip, right? But that blip dictates your exact place in this very rigid legal line.
Yeah, it's representing a slice of future potential, basically.
Exactly. And figuring out what that digital blip actually entitles you to do, and just mastering the foundation of equity investing. That's exactly what we are unpacking today in this deep dive.
Yeah.
So we're essentially tearing apart common stock from the ground up, because I mean, you simply cannot understand the rest of the financial markets until you deeply grasp this one core building block.
No, you really can't. I mean, everything else in finance, like preferred stock, options, corporate bonds,
right?
All of that is essentially defined by how it differs from or how it interacts with common stock.
Yeah, it's the baseline.
Exactly. If you don't have this foundational DNA mapped out in your head, the more complex topics on the Series 7 are just, well, they'll feel like a foreign language.
So completely.
Because there are roughly, I'd say, 18 equity-focused questions waiting for you on the exam. And they all test whether you truly understand the mechanics of this one specific asset class.
Right. And I want to ground this in reality immediately, because abstract rules can get dry.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's introduce a character to help us out. We'll call him Frank the Founder.
Frank the Founder. Okay. I like it.
Yeah. And Frank runs this volatile, highly ambitious company. Let's call it Self-Heating Biometric Socks, Inc.
Wow. Okay. Self-Heating Biometric Socks.
Yeah. He's trying to revolutionize winter footwear. He's just pending a few, you know, FDA approvals for the biometric sensors, but he's getting there.
Sure. Minor details.
Right. And now let's bring in an investor. We'll call her Cautious Kathy. And she buys common stock in Frank's company. Now, our sources define her purchase as an equity ownership interest with a, and this is the quote, residual claim and no maturity date.
Right.
So let's break down that legal jargon. What is the actual mechanism of a residual claim?
Well, the mechanism is all about the capital stack.
Okay.
Which is just the hierarchy of who gets paid when a company liquidates.
The pecking order.
Exactly. Being the residual claimant means Kathy is standing at the absolute back of the line.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. If Frank's company goes bankrupt and its assets are sold off, the banks, they take their cut first.
Makes sense.
Then the bondholders step up. Then the suppliers get paid.
Right.
Then the preferred stockholders.
And then Kathy.
Right. Kathy only gets the residue. She gets whatever is left over after every single legal obligation has been satisfied.
So she's taking on, I mean, really the maximum amount of structural risk there.
Oh, yeah.
But there's also that element of time we mentioned. She bought something with no expiration date.
Right. Because common stock has no maturity.
Okay.
Unlike a bond, which has a specific date where the company has to pay you back your principal, Frank's company never owes Kathy her money back.
Wow.
As long as the corporation exists, she is an owner. Her investment is locked in indefinitely. Well, until she sells those shares on the secondary market to someone else.
Oh, right, right. So I'm looking at this from Kathy's perspective. And frankly, being last in line with no guarantee of ever getting your money back sounds like a pretty terrible deal.
It does sound bad when you frame it that way.
Yeah, but I mean, the entire global economy is built on this.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason she wants this has to be the risk-reward trade-off, right?
That is exactly it. It's two sides of the same coin. The unlimited time horizon combined with being last in line for the assets, that is the exact mechanical reason why common stock has unlimited upside potential.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, the creditors and bondholders in front of her, they have a legal guarantee to get their money,
right?
But their upside is strictly capped at their fixed interest rate. They will never make a penny more than what's in their contract.
So they have a ceiling.
Exactly. Kathy has no floor, but she also has no ceiling.
Oh, okay.
If self-heating biometric socks become a global phenomenon, the stock can appreciate infinitely.
Right. It's like a casino where the most you can lose is the chips you put on the table.
Mm.
But the winnings, they have absolutely no ceiling. You can just keep winning.
That's a great way to look at it. It's the ultimate leveraged position on the company's future.
Okay, but let's look at the worst case scenario.
Let's do it.
Because things go wrong. Say Frank's biometric sensors have a catastrophic malfunction.
Oh no.
Yeah, they overheat. They cause severe burns to thousands of customers.
That's bad.
It's terrible. And the resulting class action lawsuit is for $50 million.
Wow. Okay.
But the company only has $10 million in assets. So Self Heating Socks Inc. is completely bankrupted.
Right.
Can those injured customers or their lawyers, can they come after Cautious Kathy's personal savings account or her house to cover that remaining 40 million?
They cannot. And that's due to the legal shield of limited liability.
Okay.
When a corporation is formed, it becomes a distinct legal entity. It is completely separate from its owners.
Right.
So the creditors can drain every single penny out of the corporation itself, but they cannot pierce the corporate veil to touch Kathy's personal assets.
Okay, but I know a lot of test takers fall into a trap here because they misinterpret what limited liability actually protects you from.
Yes, this is where the exam tries to get you.
Okay, how so?
The exam writers love to present a catastrophic bankruptcy scenario, kind of like the one you just described,
Right.
and then they ask what the common shareholder owes. The trap is assuming the shareholder is protected from any and all financial pain.
Oh, I see.
You are protected from the corporation's external debts, sure, but your initial investment is fully exposed.
So if she put in money, that's gone.
Exactly. If Kathy paid $50,000 for those shares, that money is incinerated.
Poof.
She loses 100% of her investment. Her liability is simply limited to the amount she put on the table.
So you lose your chips, but you don't lose your car.
Exactly.
Okay. So Kathy owns this residual piece of the pie. And her downside is capped at her investment. But how do we know exactly how many pieces of the pie exist in the first place?
That's a great question.
Because we need to track that. We need to look at the hierarchy of share classifications,
Right.
which dictates corporate control and drives major financial metrics.
Yes. So we need to categorize shares into four distinct buckets:
Okay.
authorized, issued, treasury, and outstanding.
See, I always visualize this as a set of Russian nesting dolls.
Oh, I like
Yeah,
that.
it helps me picture it.
Yeah.
The largest outermost doll that contains everything else, that's the authorized shares.
Right.
So when Frank files his corporate charter with the state of Delaware, he has to set a hard ceiling on the total number of shares his company is ever legally allowed to create.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's say he authorizes 10 million shares.
Okay. And that authorized number is static. Frank cannot simply authorize another 5 million shares next year just because he feels like it.
Right. He can't just print more dolls.
Exactly. Expanding the authorized pool requires amending the corporate charter, and that mandates a majority vote from the existing shareholders.
Okay. So inside that massive 10 million share doll, we have a smaller doll. And those are the issued shares.
Right.
Because Frank doesn't need to sell all 10 million shares on day one.
No, that would be rare.
Right. He might issue 8 million shares to the public to raise his initial startup capital. So those 8 million have been distributed into the wild, and the remaining 2 million are unissued. They're just sitting in the corporate vault waiting for a rainy day.
Right. So issued shares represent the historical total of everything the company has ever sold to the public.
Okay.
And this leads to an important corporate action. What happens if Frank's company becomes massively profitable?
Like the socks actually take off. Right. The socks are a hit, and he decides to use some of that cash to buy back his own stock from the open market.
Well, that brings in the third nesting doll, right? Treasury stock.
Exactly.
Treasury stock consists of previously issued shares that the corporation has repurchased. But wait, let's pause and look at the financial engineering behind this.
Okay.
Why would Frank spend corporate cash to buy back shares instead of, building a new factory or doing more R&D?
It's really all about consolidating value.
Okay.
By repurchasing shares, Frank reduces the supply of stock floating around in the open market.
Oh, supply and demand.
Exactly. When supply drops and demand remains constant, the price per share mechanically rises.
Makes sense.
It also signals to the market that management believes their own stock is currently undervalued.
Like they're saying, hey, our best investment is ourselves.
Precisely.
Okay, so Frank buys back 1 million shares and puts them in the corporate treasury. That leaves us with the final, smallest nesting doll. And this is the most critical number for investors.
Yes, it is.
Outstanding shares.
Right. Outstanding shares are the shares currently held by the investing public. This includes retail investors like Kathy and, large institutions.
Okay, so I want the listener to think about this for a second.
Yeah.
We're going to do a little math.
Oh, boy.
It's easy math, I promise.
Yeah.
Okay, pause and think. If Frank authorizes 10 million shares, issues 8 million of them to the public, and then later buys back 1 million shares into the treasury. What is the outstanding share count? Think about it.
Do you have it?
Okay, so what's the answer?
It's 7 million.
Right.
The defining formula you need to burn into your brain is outstanding equals issued minus treasury.
Okay, outstanding equals issued minus treasury. So 8 million issued minus 1 million in treasury leaves 7 million outstanding in the hands of the public.
Exactly.
Now, this distinction is heavily tested, right?
Yeah.
Specifically regarding how treasury stock is classified.
Yes. Pay close attention to this next part, because this is where the exam tries to get you. It is a classic trick.
Okay, lay it on us.
The exam will ask if treasury stock is considered issued or outstanding.
Ah.
Think back to the nesting dolls. Once a share leaves the company and is sold to the public, it becomes issued.
Right.
It never loses that status. So when Frank buys it back, it is still an issued share.
But it.
However, because it is no longer in the hands of the public, it is not outstanding.
Okay. So treasury stock is issued, but not outstanding.
Correct.
And because it's essentially owned by the company itself, it kind of loses its privileges, right?
Yeah.
Like Frank doesn't get to pay himself dividends on treasury stock.
No, absolutely not.
And he certainly doesn't get to cast votes with it.
Right. It's dormant.
It's just sitting there.
Yeah. But its absence from the outstanding count is what drives the math for investors.
How so?
Well, outstanding shares act as the denominator for key financial metrics, like earnings per share or EPS.
Right, EPS.
So if Frank's company makes $7 million in net income and there are 7 million outstanding shares, the EPS is $1.
Okay. And if Frank buys back another 3.5 million shares, reducing the outstanding count to just 3.5 million?
Yeah.
Suddenly, that same $7 million in profit gets divided by a much smaller number.
Exactly.
So the EPS jumps to $2, even though the underlying business didn't actually make any more money.
Right.
It's purely mechanical.
Which is exactly why Wall Street scrutinizes the outstanding share count so closely. It changes the perceived value of the stock.
Okay, so we've got millions of shares constantly shifting. They're being issued, bought back, traded daily on the secondary market between thousands of different Cathys.
Yeah, it's a lot of movement.
The logistics of that are staggering.
Yeah.
If Frank is a chaotic visionary, you know, focused on biometric sensors, He is definitely not tracking who owns what.
No, Frank is terrible at paperwork.
So who on earth is keeping track of the paperwork so Frank doesn't accidentally issue 11 million shares?
Well, the financial system relies on two separate entities to maintain the integrity of this entire structure.
Okay.
The transfer agent and the registrar.
Oh, the transfer agent and the registrar. Okay.
Yes. These two entities serve completely different functions, but they work in tandem to act as the paperwork police.
All right. I like that. The paperwork police. Let's give them distinct personas to tell them apart because they do get confusing.
They do.
So the transfer agent, I picture the transfer agent as this massive, highly efficient logistics hub. Like they handle all the messy human elements of stock ownership.
That's a perfect way to describe it. The transfer agent is responsible for the daily mechanics.
Right.
So when Cautious Cathy sells her 100 shares to another investor, the transfer agent cancels Cathy's old certificate, issues the new certificate to the buyer, and updates the official master list of shareholders.
Okay, so they're in the weeds.
Very much so. If Cathy moves, they update her address. They are the ones physically mailing out the dividend checks and sending out the proxy voting materials.
Okay, so they are the busy clerks. Now, contrast that with the registrar, because the registrar is not mailing out dividend checks, right?
Right, definitely not.
I view the registrar as like a cold, detached audit algorithm. Usually it's a bank or a trust company, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. The registrar doesn't care about the daily hustle of who sold what to whom.
They don't care about Cathy's new address.
Right. Their sole mandate is to look over the transfer agent's shoulder and verify the aggregate math.
Okay.
They audit the daily share counts to ensure one critical rule is never broken. And that rule is the corporation must never issue more shares than its charter has authorized.
So they are the fail-safe against overissuance.
Precisely.
Which is a big deal because historically, before all these systems were digitized, corrupt companies could literally just secretly print more stock certificates than they were allowed to.
Oh yeah, it happened all the time.
And that would dilute the existing shareholders into oblivion, causing absolute chaos when those fake shares hit the market.
It was a disaster.
So the registrar stands at the vault door, making sure that if the charter says 10 million authorized, the issued count never hits 10 million and one.
Right. And because of the severity of that risk, there is a fundamental regulatory requirement here.
Wait, hold on. Let me just pause you right there.
Sure.
If you are listening to this, I want you to write this down on your hand.
Okay.
This is a huge rule.
It is a massive rule.
The transfer agent and the registrar cannot be the same entity. The independence requirement is absolute.
Absolutely. You cannot have the person managing the daily share issuance also be the person auditing the final count.
It's just a blatant conflict of interest.
Exactly.
Okay, so the paperwork is pristine. The transfer agent updates the list. The registrar audits the count. And Cautious Kathy is officially registered as holding her 100 shares of outstanding stock.
Right.
We know she's last in line for liquidation if things go south.
Right.
But what active powers does that piece of paper or that digital blip actually grant her while the company is thriving?
Well, a share of common stock is a bundle of rights. These rights dictate who controls the company, how ownership is protected from dilution, and who gets access to corporate financials.
Let's start with control, which in corporate terms means voting rights.
Yes. Common stockholders vote on major corporate structural changes.
Like what?
Mergers, stock splits, and most importantly, electing the board of directors.
Okay, but they aren't voting on daily operations, right? Yeah. Like Kathy doesn't get to vote on what color the new biometric socks should be.
No. Management handles that. But when it comes to electing the board, the mechanics of how the votes are tallied can drastically shift the balance of power.
Ah.
So we need to compare statutory voting against cumulative voting.
All right, let's set up a scenario. Cautious Kathy owns 100 shares, and Frank unfortunately has lost his mind and wants to pivot the company into developing AI-powered self-heating underwear.
Oh boy. That sounds dangerous.
Right. Kathy views this as a liability nightmare and she wants to stop it.
Understandably.
So there is an annual shareholder meeting coming up, and three open seats on the board of directors are up for election. Kathy wants to elect a sensible, cautious director to at least one of those seats to kind of pump the brakes on Frank's new product line.
Okay, so if the company uses statutory voting, which, by the way, is the default for most corporations,
right.
It feels like a winner-take-all system where the majority steamrolls everyone else.
How does that math work?
Well, under statutory voting, you get one vote per share for each open seat.
Okay.
So Kathy has 100 votes for seat A, 100 votes for seat B, and 100 votes for seat C. Crucially, she cannot transfer those votes between candidates.
Ah, I see. So if Frank owns 500 shares, he casts 500 votes for his crazy candidate in seat A, 500 in seat B, and 500 in seat C. And Kathy casts her 100 for each. So Frank wins every single seat.
Yep. Statutory voting provides zero proportional representation. It entirely favors the majority shareholder.
Okay, well, that stinks for Kathy.
It does. Which brings us to the alternative, cumulative voting. And this changes the mathematical strategy completely.
So under cumulative voting, Kathy still has 100 shares, and there are still three open seats. But the rules of engagement shift.
Right. Under cumulative voting, you pool your total voting power.
Pool it. Okay.
You take the number of shares owned and you multiply it by the number of open seats.
Okay. So 100 shares multiplied by three seats equals a pool of 300 total votes.
Exactly. And the strategic advantage is that Kathy can allocate those 300 votes however she wants.
Oh. So she can ignore seat B and seat C entirely and just dump all 300 votes onto her one sensible candidate for C-Day.
Precisely. By concentrating her voting power and perhaps pooling her votes with a few other retail investors, Kathy can guarantee she wins at least that single seat.
Which ensures her voice is actually heard in the boardroom, even if she owns a tiny fraction of the overall company.
Right. And this is where the exam tries to get you again.
Let me guess. It's about the naming.
Exactly. The wording on the test will try to trick you because cumulative sounds like a massive institutional word.
Yeah, it sounds like big money.
Right, leading people to assume it benefits the big players. But cumulative voting is explicitly designed to benefit minority shareholders. It's their only defense mechanism against a hostile majority.
Okay, that makes a ton of sense. Speaking of defense mechanisms, we need to address dilution.
Dilution is a big one.
Because what happens if Frank wants to issue 2 million of those unissued shares we talked about, the ones sitting in the vault?
Right.
Say he wants to issue them to raise capital for his new underwear project. If the pie gets bigger, but Kathy's slice stays the exact same size, her percentage of ownership shrinks.
Yes. her voting power is diluted.
This is where preemptive rights come in, right?
Yeah, all right.
It's essentially an anti-dilution shield.
Exactly. Preemptive rights give existing shareholders the right to purchase a proportionate share of any newly issued stock before it is offered to the general public.
Okay, so if Kathy currently owns 1% of the outstanding shares, Frank has to come to her first.
Right. He must offer her the opportunity to buy 1% of this new stock issuance, usually at a slightly discounted subscription price, before underwriters sell it to anyone else.
And this allows her to maintain her exact 1% ownership stake.
If she wants to, yes.
But here is a critical question for the listener. Let's think about the corporate bureaucracy involved in this for a second.
It's a nightmare.
Right. If a company has 1 million retail investors, tracking them all down to offer them a few shares before a major capital raise is incredibly annoying and slow. So, do existing common shareholders automatically have preemptive rights?
What do you think?
Have you got your answer?
They do not.
Right.
Preemptive rights are not an automatic feature of common stock. They must be explicitly written into the corporate charter.
So if the charter is silent on the matter, Kathy has no preemptive rights, and she will absolutely get diluted during a new offering.
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay, so let's shift from control to cash flow. Let's talk dividends.
Ah, dividends. Yeah. Everyone's favorite topic.
Because if Frank's sock business is printing money, does Kathy have a legal right to a dividend check every quarter?
No. She has no legal right to dividends whatsoever.
Wait, really?
Really. The board of directors has sole discretion over whether to declare a dividend.
So they can just hold on to all the cash?
Yep. They can decide to reinvest every single penny of profit back into the company for the next 10 years, and Kathy just has to accept it.
Wow.
Furthermore, unlike cumulative preferred stock, where skipped dividends accumulate as dividends in arrears and must eventually be paid out.
Right.
If the board skips a common dividend, it is gone forever.
Okay. So she can't force them to pay her. Can she at least see what they are doing with the profits? Like, what are the legalities surrounding the inspection of corporate books?
Well, common shareholders do have the right to inspect corporate records, such as financial statements and the master shareholder list.
Okay, that's something.
However, they cannot just demand access on a whim. They must demonstrate a proper purpose.
I imagine proper purpose is a bit of a legal minefield.
It absolutely is. You can't just demand the books because you want to steal their client list to start a rival company.
Or just to harass management because the stock price dropped.
Exactly. A proper purpose must be directly related to the shareholders' interest in the corporation.
Like what? What's an example?
So, investigating credible allegations of financial fraud by the CEO. Proper purpose.
Good.
Requesting the shareholder list to communicate with other investors about pooling cumulative votes for an upcoming board election. Also a proper purpose.
Right. But general curiosity or corporate espionage are explicitly rejected.
Correct.
Okay. Let's tie this all back to the absolute worst case scenario. We talked about Kathy being the residual claimant earlier.
Right.
But I want to walk through the actual risk-reward pricing of the capital stack during a liquidation, just as a recap.
It's good to drill this in.
So Frank's company goes completely under. They liquidate the factories and the patents into a pile of cash. The line forms. Let's rank them 1 to 5.
Okay, rank 1. First in line are the secured creditors.
So these are banks whose loans are backed by specific hard assets, like a mortgage on the factory.
Yes. And because their risk is incredibly low, I mean, they can just seize the building if Frank defaults, they accept the lowest interest rates.
Right. Rank 2. Next are the unsecured and general creditors.
This includes suppliers who shipped materials on credit, but critically, it includes debenture holders.
Debentures.
Yeah. These are investors who bought corporate bonds backed only by the company's full faith and credit. Not a specific asset.
Rank 3.
Third in line are subordinated debt holders. These are bondholders who explicitly agreed to stand behind the general creditors in the event of bankruptcy.
Why would they agree to that?
Because in exchange for taking on that additional structural risk, they demand a higher yield. Risk and reward are perfectly correlated here.
Rank 4.
Fourth are the preferred stockholders. They get their stated par value claim satisfied before any common equity sees a dime.
And finally, rank 5, fifth in line.
The common stockholders, the residual claim. Cautious Kathy is dead last.
Dead last. Okay, it's easy to look at shares as static ownership in a static company. But the real complexity, and where investors often trip up on taxes on the exam, happens when the corporation's DNA itself mutates through major restructurings.
Yeah, this is where it gets interesting.
Like, what if Frank decides to split the company in two or merge with a massive rival? Let's analyze how Kathy's shares handle spin-offs and mergers.
Because they share a fascinating underlying tax logic, which is defer now, recognize later.
Right. Defer now, recognize later. Spin-offs and mergers are corporate actions moving in opposite directions. A spin-off divides a company, while a merger combines two. Let's start with spin-off.
Okay, so Frank realizes that his experimental R&D division for self-cooling hats is actually incredibly valuable.
Naturally.
But the market isn't recognizing it because it's buried inside the struggling sock company. So he decides to spin off the hat division into its own entirely separate publicly traded company.
Right. Mechanically, Kathy receives shares of this new subsidiary as a dividend. She doesn't pay any cash.
Nope.
One day she owns stock in one company, and the next day she owns stock in two separate companies.
And the intuitive reaction for a retail investor is, amazing, Frank just gave me free stock, free money.
But I want to use a biological analogy here because it's not free money. A spinoff is not printing new money, it's cellular mitosis.
Mitosis. Okay, biology lesson.
The parent cell divides. The total biomass remains exactly the same, it's just split across two entities. The market capitalization of the parent company will adjust downward to reflect the exact value of the division that just left.
That's a great analogy. And the IRS views it exactly the same way. Since no new wealth was actually created, it's a tax-free event.
Right.
But Kathy's original cost basis, the DNA of her investment, has to replicate and divide between the two new cells.
And the rule for how that basis splits is strictly determined by the relative fair market value, or FMV, of the two companies immediately after the spinoff occurs.
So let's walk through the math. Let's say Kathy originally invested $10,000 into Frank's parent company.
Okay, 10 grand.
After the spinoff, the open market determines that Frank's original sock company represents 70% of the total combined value, and the new hat subsidiary represents 30%.
Right. So Kathy takes her $10,000 cost basis and splits it using those exact percentages.
Right.
70% or $7,000 remains her basis in the parent sock company. 30% or $3,000 becomes her established basis in the new hat company.
Exactly.
So her total basis across both accounts is still $10,000. She hasn't realized any taxable gains.
And critically, the IRS applies the holding period rule of tacking on.
What does that mean?
Well, if Kathy held the parent stock for 2 years before the spinoff and decides to sell her newly acquired hat shares the very next week, the IRS treats it as a long-term capital gain.
Oh, because the holding period of the parent shares tax onto the new subsidiary shares.
Exactly. Because it's viewed as a continuation of the same original investment risk.
It's all about continuity.
Yep.
Okay, so that's a spinoff. Mitosis. Now let's look at a merger. Frank's company is acquired by a massive competitor. The target shareholders, like Kathy, exchange their old Frank shares for new shares of the acquiring behemoth based on an exchange ratio.
Right. And if this combination qualifies under the tax code, specifically a Type B reorganization, it is also a tax-free event.
But the mechanical rule for a Type B reorganization is incredibly strict. The acquiring company must purchase the target using solely voting stock.
Right. No cash can change hands.
Why is that?
The logic here is identical to the spinoff. If Kathy simply trades one stock for another, her investment risk hasn't been cashed out. She's just rolling her risk into a larger vehicle.
Okay.
Her old cost basis becomes her substituted basis in the new shares, and her holding period tax on. No tax event is triggered.
But what if the acquiring company uses a more flexible Type A statutory merger and they try to sweeten the deal?
They love to do that.
Right. They say, Kathy, we will give you our new stock, but we'll also throw in $1,000 in cash.
Mm-hmm.
The introduction of cash fundamentally alters the tax treatment. We call this non-stock consideration boot.
Boot, yes. The moment boot enters a reorganization, the tax-free deferral is partially shattered.
And the mechanical reason for that is simple. Cash represents a finalized realization of value.
Right.
You cannot defer taxes on pure cash sitting in your checking account. The IRS views that portion of the transaction as closed.
Exactly. So boot triggers immediate gain recognition. If Kathy receives $1,000 in boot, she must recognize a taxable capital gain up to the amount of the boot she received.
Okay, but the exam writers, they love to flip this scenario to test your deeper understanding.
Yes, they do.
What if Kathy's original investment in Frank's company was a disaster?
Like she's down 50%.
Yeah, what if she is sitting on a massive unrealized loss when the merger happens? If she receives boot, does she get to recognize that loss for a tax write-off?
And this is where the exam tries to get you.
Okay.
A lot of test takers assume that if boot triggers a gain, it must trigger a loss. That is false. In a reorganization exchange, a loss is never recognized, even when boot is received.
Well, and why is that? It seems unfair.
Because the overarching transaction is still a reorganization, not a final liquidation. She is still holding shares in the surviving entity.
Okay.
So the IRS dictates that the unrealized loss must be deferred and baked into the adjusted basis of her new shares. You recognize gain up to the boot. You never recognize a loss.
Okay, that is a huge point. Before we move on from mergers entirely, we need to clarify the regulatory oversight here.
Sure.
If a publicly traded company is merging and exchanging new shares, the SEC gets involved.
Mm-hmm.
This brings up the reorganization rule.
Right. The reorganization rule requires that the new securities being issued in the merger must be registered with the SEC, and the shareholders must receive a disclosure document detailing the transaction.
Okay, so here is the logical deduction I want the listener to make.
Yeah.
Based on that rule, does the SEC's reorganization rule force the company to hold a shareholder vote to approve the merger?
What do you think?
Got your answer.
No, it does not. The SEC regulates securities registration and disclosure. They do not regulate corporate governance.
So they can't force the vote.
Right. The legal requirement to actually hold a shareholder vote to approve a merger comes entirely from state corporate law, like the Delaware Court of Chancery, or from the corporation's own charter.
So the SEC mandates the paperwork, so Kathy knows what she's voting on, but the state mandates the vote itself.
Exactly. It's a subtle distinction that separates those who merely memorize rules from those who actually understand the regulatory framework.
Okay, so we've spent this entire time analyzing SEC-registered corporate actions and major exchanges.
We have.
I want to leave cautious Kathy behind for a minute and descend into what I like to call the regulatory underworld.
Oh, this is the fun part.
Yeah, we are shifting from corporate structure to high-pressure sales tactics. Let's introduce a new character, Desperate Dan.
Desperate Dan, okay.
Dan is chasing astronomical returns. He's easily swayed by aggressive marketing and is currently talking to a broker who is pushing a highly speculative mining company called Laser Pointer Inc.
Laser Pointer Inc.?
Yep. We are entering the highly regulated arena of penny stocks.
The Wild West.
The SEC heavily regulates this specific sector because the low liquidity and the total lack of institutional oversight make these assets incredibly susceptible to market manipulation.
Specifically, pump and dump schemes.
Right. Let's walk through the mechanics of a pump and dump so we understand why these penny stock rules even exist.
Okay, so in a pump and dump, shady promoters accumulate millions of shares of a nearly worthless stock at, say, 5 cents a share.
Dirt cheap.
Right. They then launch an aggressive, misleading marketing campaign. Email blasts, cold calls, claiming the company just discovered a massive gold vein or some new technology.
And this artificial hype creates a surge in demand. Retail investors like Dan flood in, driving the price up to, let's say, $2 a share. This is the pump.
Exactly. And once the price peaks, the original promoters sell off all their accumulated shares at massive profits.
Dumping them on the market.
Right. This overwhelming sell pressure collapses the stock price back to pennies. The promoters walk away rich, and Dan is left holding a totally worthless portfolio. This is the dump.
It's brutal. And because of this exact predatory mechanism, the SEC defines penny stocks strictly.
Very strictly.
Okay, I want the listener to answer this directly. Think about this. If Dan buys a stock trading at $3 a share on the NASDAQ exchange, is that legally a penny stock?
Think about it for a second.
Do you have an answer?
It is not.
Nope.
The legal definition of a penny stock requires two distinct conditions to be met simultaneously.
Okay, below there.
The stock must be unlisted, meaning it trades over the counter and not on a national exchange like the NYSE or NASDAQ, and it must be priced below $5 a share.
Unlisted AD under $5. So a $3 stock on the NASDAQ is just a cheap listed security.
Exactly. It has the regulatory oversight of the exchange, so it avoids the penny stock classification entirely.
Okay, but if Laser Pointer Inc. is unlisted and trading at $2, it falls into the trap.
Yes, it does.
The broker cannot simply take Dan's money and execute the trade.
No. They must force Dan through a literal gauntlet of disclosures.
A tauntlet?
Yeah. Designed specifically to create friction and break the psychological spell of a high-pressure sales pitch.
So what does this disclosure gauntlet actually consist of? Let's go through it.
Okay. First, the broker must provide a standard risk disclosure document. This details the extreme volatility and low liquidity of the over-the-counter market.
Okay.
Dan must physically sign and date an acknowledgement that he received it. Crucially, the broker must wait 2 full business days after sending it before they're legally allowed to affect the trade.
So it's a mandatory cooling off period.
Yep.
If Dan is swept up in FOMO on a Tuesday, he can't buy until Thursday, which gives him time to actually research the company.
Exactly.
What else?
Second, a current quotation disclosure. The broker must reveal the inside bid and offer prices, exposing the spread, which in penny stocks can be massive and instantly put the buyer at a loss the moment they buy.
Ouch. Okay.
Third, compensation disclosures.
Oh, this one is fascinating to me. They have to tell Dan exactly how much the broker is making off the trade.
Yes, and it's split into 2 separate disclosures. They must disclose the firm's aggregate compensation, AND. They must explicitly disclose the exact commission the individual salesperson on the phone is pocketing.
Wow. I mean, seeing a massive commission structure would certainly make me question the broker's motives.
That's the whole point.
Right.
And finally, the most burdensome requirement of all, the suitability statement.
What does that entail?
The firm must generate a customized written statement analyzing Dan's specific financial situation, his investment experience, and detailing exactly why this highly speculative penny stock is actually suitable for his portfolio.
That's a lot of work.
It is. Dan must sign and date this statement, agreeing to the specific security and quantity. And just like the risk document, this triggers its own waiting period.
Now, the Series 7 writers know that memorizing the gauntlet is pretty easy. The trap lies in the exemptions to the gauntlet.
Yes.
What if Dan isn't a new victim? What if he's an experienced penny stock trader who has an established relationship with this broker?
The SEC provides an exemption for what they call established customer.
Okay, how do you qualify?
If Dan has held an account with this firm for more than 1 year, or R, if he has previously executed 3 separate penny stock trades on 3 separate days involving 3 different issuers, he qualifies as an established customer.
Okay, so if he meets that 3 trades or 1 year threshold, what exactly is he exempt from? Does he skip the cooling off period and the risk document?
This is a massive trap.
I knew it.
The established customer exemption only waives the requirement for the written suitability statement. That's it.
Wait, really? So Dan still has to get the risk disclosure document.
Yes.
He still has to wait 2 days.
Yes.
He still gets the quotation and compensation disclosures.
Correct. The risk disclosure is inevitable. The exemption solely removes the burden of the firm having to write a customized suitability essay for a client who clearly already understands the game.
Okay, that makes sense. Let me extrapolate a broader regulatory concept here, though. We established that Laser Pointer Inc. was unlisted and under $5.
Right.
What if Dan finds a different over-the-counter stock, completely unlisted, but it's currently trading at $60 a share?
Okay.
It bypasses the penny stock rules completely because of its price. Does that mean the broker can just blindly recommend it?
Absolutely not. FINRA imposes a broader rule covering all OTC equity securities, regardless of whether they cost 50 cents or $500.
Okay.
Before a firm can recommend any unlisted equity to a customer, the firm must perform a documented financial review of the issuer.
So they have to verify the company actually has a pulse.
Precisely. For a domestic issuer, the firm must review a current balance sheet, which means it must be dated less than 15 months prior to the recommendation.
Right.
The OTC market is just too opaque. The broker is legally obligated to peer into that opacity and confirm the company's financial reality before exposing their client to it.
That's a good safeguard. Okay, we have excavated a massive amount of structural knowledge today, from the genesis of Frank's authorized shares all the way down to the regulatory friction protecting Desperate Dan.
We've covered a lot of ground.
So I want to initiate a final reset to really lock these mechanisms into our listeners' short-term memory before exam day. We are shifting into lightning round mode.
Oh, I love the lightning round.
Rapid-fire takeaways. I'll set up the concept. You knock down the core testable rule. Ready?
Let's do it.
The formula for outstanding shares.
Outstanding equals issued minus treasury. It is the denominator for EPS and book value.
The paperwork police. Transfer agent versus registrar.
The transfer agent handles the daily logistics and mailings. The registrar audits the aggregate count to prevent overissuance. They absolutely must be independent entities.
The strategic difference in voting methods.
Statutory voting favors the majority. Cumulative voting explicitly empowers minority shareholders by allowing them to pool all their votes onto a single board candidate.
The capital stack. Where does common stock sit in a liquidation?
Dead last. behind secured debt, unsecured debt, subordinated debt, and preferred stock. The residual claim means maximum risk for maximum infinite upside.
Tax treatment of a spinoff.
The original cost basis splits based on the relative fair market value of the entities immediately after the spinoff. The parents holding period tax onto the new subsidiary shares.
Type B reorganizations and the impact of Boot.
Type B requires solely voting stock. The introduction of Boot, usually cash, triggers immediate gain recognition up to the amount of the Boot. Crucially, a loss is never recognized in a reorganization, even with Boot.
The strict definition of a penny stock.
It must simultaneously be unlisted A and D priced below $5 a share.
Penny stock established customer exemptions.
Three trades on separate days with separate issuers or an account open for 1 year. This exemption only gets you out of the suitability statement. It never waives the risk disclosure document.
That is a lightning round. That is the fundamental DNA of equity.
You know, I want to leave the listener with one final concept to mull over as they return to their study materials.
Yeah, please do.
Think about the tension we just mapped out today. It's a constant tug of war between corporate flexibility, like Frank, wanting to raise authorized shares, spin off experimental divisions, or merge to grow his empire, and shareholder protection.
Right, like preemptive rights protecting against dilution,
Yeah.
cumulative voting protecting the minority voice.
Exactly. Every single regulatory friction point we covered, from the SEC's reorganization rule forcing disclosure documents to the OTC balance sheet review to the 2-day cooling off period for penny stocks,
Yeah.
it all exists because someone, at some point in financial history, tried to exploit the system and tip the balance entirely in their own favor.
That is so true.
The rules you are memorizing for the Series 7 are just the scar tissue of the market trying to keep the playing field level.
Yeah.
If you can understand why the rule was written, the exact mechanical exploit it's trying to prevent, the exam questions shift from arbitrary memorization to logical deduction.
It's all about balancing the scales of risk and reward. And if you can visualize Frank, Kathy, and Dan navigating those scales, you are going to absolutely crush this section. Get out there, remember the nesting dolls, remember your outstanding formula, and go dominate the Series 7.